everybody. This is Dan, the Lonely Havoc, and this is the Havoccast podcast. It's your favorite podcast about tabletop war games, role-playing games, and of course, the people that play them. That's you. You're the people, my people out there. I hope everyone's doing great, enjoying the summer. It's really hot outside. It's a little bit miserable. Made the tactical error of going camping in this last weekend, and it was really, really hot and uncomfortable, and none of us slept, but the time on the river that we spent was fantastic. Hey, there's a lot of awesome stuff going on at the Havoc offices here. I am now doing a Twitch stream with my good buddy, Andrew Hobbyvices Dart. Finally jumped into the Twitch streaming. A bunch of people said that it's a thing we should definitely do. I've been meaning to try it, and now it's here. It's the Heroes Brush Hour. You can find it on Twitch TV, of course. My friend Andrew and I challenge each other to try to paint the model within 1 hour time frame with some distractions by our viewers. It's a good time. It's mostly just me giving Andrew a hard time and watching him struggle to paint models within an hour. And it's fantastic. I'm really loving it. It's just a great way for me to interact with community, meet more people, and hopefully encourage people to paint. So even more exciting than any of that is today's podcast. I am speaking with none other than author Graham McNeil. Graham McNeil is an award-winning New York Times best-selling author. He's a screenwriter of sci-fi, fantasy, horror. He does games. And if you know Black Library, you know Graham McNeil. He's written so many books within the Warhammer universe, a lot of the Horus Heresy novels, which are fantastic. And it's super exciting for me to be able to have spoken with him, being a writer myself, or a fledgling writer, if you will. I'm working on my degree in creative writing as well, so it was fantastic to sit back and mostly listen to Graham give great advice, tell some awesome stories, and I learned a lot in this interview, and I think it's fantastic. So, without further ado, Graham McNeil. Well, hey everybody, I've got Graham here. Hey Graham, how's it going?
Not too bad, Dan. Enjoying a leisurely Sunday, so all things considered, very good.
Very good. Awesome, man. I appreciate you coming on. Are you ready to answer 20 odd questions?
Well, I'm here. Whether I'm ready or not, we'll soon find out, but let's give it a try.
I mean, are we ever really ready for anything?
Exactly. You know, we can start off. Ready for anything. We just do the best we can.
Right. I mean, we can start off existential. I'm down with that.
Wow. That's a hard left turn into philosophy from the very off.
That's what I do.
My Nietzsche. Let's go.
Nice. Usually I try to get everyone comfortable before I hit them with the heavy stuff. But
the real existential stuff.
Yeah, let's just go out and hit it hard right away. First question. What is your favorite paint color?
I stirred a little bit of a debate on that just accidentally the other day there. The one I love using is Corn Red. That's a great red. I like my Mephiston for a bit of brightness on it. My Evil Suns one, not Suns, Wild Rider. It's always good for a highlight. But yeah, Corn Red. It's got a nice depth to it. Flows nice and easily. It looks just really rich on the miniature. So yeah, definitely Corn Red.
I've done a solid Corn Red first with Mephiston over it, and I think that's a pretty nice look.
It's all my chaplain, all my guns and my staffs of office for chaplains and what have you are all Corn Red to begin with.
Nice. I like that. Red, I just find like red, I mean, maybe it's the primary colors, just like they're so comforting to work with because you don't have to do too much to them, just like some layers and then it like turns out and you're like, yes, I've done it.
Once you've got the layers on it, if we're counting things like Null Noil or Agrax in there, they're the magic juice.
Yes,
ones you're looking at a miniature and all your base colors are on, think this is just the worst thing I've ever painted. It's so flat and boring. Then I put an ink wash over it and it's like, oh my god, I'm actually not sucky at this completely.
This looks amazing now.
It's the best thing I've ever painted.
I'm painting orange right now, and I don't know if you've ever painted orange, but it's just not. It's a difficult color to work with. Like I'm doing orange armor on some Dark Eldar guys and. Mm-hmm.
And the nearest I got to orange was Gulliman's sword, and I suddenly realized actually I don't have any orange, so it was a bit of experimental mixing with some Ethereal yellow and Mephiston to get a nice couple of layers, shades of orange for the blade.
Right. I don't know. It's not layering.
I never want to paint anything orange for that.
No, you don't. There's a reason you don't see a lot of orange models.
Yep.
So, Graham, how did you get started in the hobby?
Well, that's going back many more years than I care to count. But
way back.
The swirly music, yep. Scooby-Doo style for this. Basically, I mean, the first, I mean, I obviously when I was younger, I read, you know, the Hobbit as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I loved fantasy sort of things. I played a tiny bit of D&D when I was very young and didn't know really at all what it was all about.
Right. Yeah. Then,
I'd been trailing around a whole bunch of bookstores with my mother when I was about, I think about 11 or so. Because the school I was going to go to needed you had to set an entrance exam to prove you weren't a complete idiot to get into it, something. And I mean, they still let me in regardless. But we
traveled
around a whole load of bookstores looking for like revision text, cliff notes, that sort of thing.
Okay, yeah.
And
yeah.
By the end of the day, I was like, oh my god, I just can't do this anymore. And my mom was like, well, you've been very good, so you pick a book out of the bookstore and we'll buy it for you.
Yes.
And I saw this one. Oh, that looks cool. It's this wizard looking dude with this dragon coming out of an orb. That's kind of cool. And it was The Warlock of Firetop Mountain, the first of the Steve Jackson, Ian Livingstone fighting fantasy books.
Okay.
I opened this up and I was like, what the hell is this? What's all these numbered passages?
Yeah.
And, you know, read what it was. Oh, all right, that's cool. And played it and just absolutely fell in love with the format. So I got my mum to buy me all of the fight, all, you know, Citadel of Chaos, Forest of Doom, and all the rest of it.
Right. Yeah.
And I lived in those books, just telling a different story every time.
Right.
And it was, you know, that was my gateway drug, you know, fighting fantasy books to D&D to Warhammer Fantasy role play. And then the more I played those games, the more I realized that I very much preferred to be the DM. I very much preferred telling the stories rather than being a participant in it. I mean, I love playing.
Right.
I love being a PC in a role-playing game, but I much prefer the storyteller aspect of it. So I ended up running a bunch of D&D campaigns at school. I started the club up there. And that's, as far as I know, it's still going, actually, even to this day, which I haven't been back to the school for obviously quite some time, but
yeah.
last I was there, I heard, oh yeah, there's still a thriving role-playing club, and so, excellent.
They have like your picture framed up on the wall somewhere.
In a gilt frame, like the president.
Oh man, they got to.
You honor the founder, you know, send him money.
If it's not there, we need to make some calls.
Unfortunately. So yeah, I mean, from playing DM, from being the DM a lot of the times, the scope and scale of all my stories kind of started getting larger, and it was more than just dungeon bashes, it was, continents and nations at war, survival of the planet type thing. And role-playing systems obviously they're not built to carry that kind of load in terms of mass combat and so on. I remember, because playing the Enemy Within campaign, when we finally got to play the final episode of that, the Empire in Flames one, final part of that is a gigantic battle. And it's got the players moving through this moment of, and you do it from like moment to moment and give, as the DM, you're giving the scope and scale of it, but you're not actually involved in it. And I always felt, I loved that, but I wanted players to feel that they had an impact on things at the sort of macro scale as much as, individual moments of it. So we got the AD&D battle system, which was a way of, simulating mass combat systems. And it had a ton of counters in it, which was really handy because I had like 6 or 7 miniatures at the most at that point.
Right.
Again, as a system, it's not ideal. It's not a great, I mean, at least back when I played the AD&D battle system, it wasn't a great system. But then I can't remember, I don't remember where exactly I saw it. I think it might have just been a White Dwarf magazine that I saw in, a newsagent's one day and thought, oh, what's this? And I realized there was actually a Games Workshop store in Glasgow. So I went along to that and, that was, boom, the landmine went off in my head and I saw the miniatures store, played a demo game there and, walked out with the third edition, the orange hardback edition of Warhammer Fantasy Battles.
Absolutely.
Bought a whole bunch of Chaos Marauders, Chaos Warriors, and that was it. It was, slippery. Yes. Greased slope from then on.
Incredibly greased.
There was literally no stopping. I bought a ton of chaos, ton of beasts, and we played a lot of Warhammer. I mean, to the point where the role-playing stuff started to, slip in terms of regularity. You know,
yeah, that was like the backseat.
Exactly. We fought all the. We played the end of the campaign, and the battles were fought, and the players were involved, and they were running the armies, and it, you know, the world was saved, sort of thing. But we gradually started playing more and more Warhammer.
Yeah.
And again, you know, the storytelling instincts kicked in again there, because as much fun as it was to bring, okay, here's your army, here's my army, let's fight. Mm-hmm. It was like, yeah. Well, I always wanted to get more into the, well, why are we fighting?
Yeah,
what's
why are we doing this? Yeah.
What's the next battle going to be based on the results of this one? So I ended up writing little stories that would, you know, give the circumstances of the battle. Then I would do like a proto battle report before I kind of knew where they were. Then I would write a little bit of, okay, well, following the glorious defeat, blah, blah, blah. And,
yeah, it would lead absolutely.
So I was kind of doing, again, narrative campaigns before I realized that's what I was actually doing. And the more I got White Dwarf, the more I started, you know, collecting the miniatures, the codexes, the books, writing my own rules for it. And it just gradually snowballed, as it does for a lot of us, I think, to the point where eventually,
like consumes your entire existence.
Absolutely.
Like, and you end up like us with a basement full of this stuff, and people come over and they're like, what is wrong with you?
Like, wow, is this, you painted all of this, and why are there Harry Potter wands there, and why is there a sword over there? It's like, you need to go in or not at all. I played up until, you know, I played regularly, like every weekend, until, you know, we went, me and the various guys in our gaming group, we all split up to our separate ways, to university and colleges and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I kind of fell out of the hobby for a couple of years before realizing, actually, that gave me just so much pleasure to do the hobby, to play the games, to come up with the stories. And I was like, there's no reason I can't do both. So I got right back into it and, you know, started writing my own stories regardless of, you know, a battle that we were fighting or models we were pushing around the tabletop. And that eventually led me to, like, I wrote a novel while I was at university, which explains, you know, kind of why I'm not an architect right now. Spent more time doing that than I did anything else. I came into the workforce, was working in an architect's office in Glasgow, and, you know, at that point, and I frankly was not enjoying it. And I went downstairs to the local newsagent to get a sandwich for lunch, and that month's issue of White Dwarf was there. And I thought, oh, it's been a while since I've bought White Dwarf. I'll get that.
And see what's going on with the
What's happening in the hobby these days? And there was an advert in it for a staff writer at the, you know, a little quarter page advert for staff writer at the Nottingham studio. And so I was like, you know what, I hate this job right now. And, you know, the worst these guys can say to me is no. So, I'll give it a shot. And luckily, you know, two interviews later, a couple of trips to Nottingham, they offered me the job. And I was like, And that's, the rest is history, you know.
Yeah,
staff writer, White Dwarf, codexes, army books, Black Library, and here we are now, Ellie, talking to you.
The high point of your career right now.
All paths led to this point.
This moment.
This is my day.
I was, I told my wife I was interviewing you, and she's like, oh, have you read his books? And I was like, oh, yeah, I've read a few of them, I'm sure. And I started the Horus Heresy, you know, series like most of us have. And then I was like, wow, that's a lot of books.
Yep.
I was like,
31, I think.
I was like, I know I've read some of his books. I was like, oh, Fulgrim. Yeah. That's a good one. I was like, whenever you're talking about, like, Fulgrim, it's just, like, I just like books with, like, science fiction space orgies in them. That's, like, my thing, if I can get it.
You know, I try and work that into every book I write, frankly. You're just not trying hard enough if you don't.
I mean, I work that into all my work emails, too, so, I mean, we're kind of the same.
I'm happy to be a bit of an influence then. And I apologize to all your co-workers.
So if you could live in any fictional universe, what would it be?
Any fictional one? Try to think of the, you know, all the ones that I really like are pretty bloody miserable.
Right, that's like, nobody ever says 40K because you would just die immediately.
When you actually live next door to literal hell, I think that's probably not a good plan. I've just nipped down the shops. It might be 2 months or 50 years. Don't know. I think probably the Star Trek one.
Yes.
You know, I like this, the progressiveness of the Star Trek universe, and it's generally fairly safe, you know, depending on what era you live in, or
sure,
if there's a Federation starship near you, you're like, oh no, what's happening now? But generally speaking, that seems like a nicer one to live in.
Yes. We might have just become best friends because I love Star Trek. I mean, I love everything, but Star Trek, I literally watch it every night.
Yeah. I love Star Trek. Big fan of, you know, all the, you know, there's not one, I mean, the only one I didn't watch was Enterprise. But the rest, I just loved. I loved them all.
Graham, you're not missing much by not having watched Enterprise. There's somebody out there that loves Enterprise that's like, I hate this podcast. But
I hear, you know, I've heard people say, you know what, yeah, the first few episodes were a bit ropey, but then once it found its feet, and it was great, but I just, you know, it just didn't do it for me. And I like Scott Bakula, you know, Scott Bakula, big fan of Quantum Leap back in the day.
Quantum Leap was amazing.
It was great, you know, oh boy. But that fucking theme song just... Oh my god, it's like, first, you know, I sat down to watch the episode and I was like, here we go, a new Star Trek. The theme song came out, I was like, oh my god, what is this?
Yeah, I was like, is this a gratuitous, am I watching the right
animation
thing?
Shower scene, and I was like, oh come on, what are you doing here? So I never watched. I mean, I'm sure it improved and got very well, very good, and I've heard a lot of people say actually it's an underappreciated gem and yada yada, but it didn't lodge in my brain like the way all the other ones did.
Never got good. Just, like, the theme song, like when it came on, I was like, am I watching the right show? Like, is this legit?
My exact thing crossed my mind is like, what is this, like a Days of Our Lives or something we're watching?
Right.
What is this?
I feel bad because, you know, I like Scott Bakula as well. Like, I grew up watching Quantum Leap and just like being so stoked about it. And then I was like, oh man, yeah. Because, you know, I watched, I retired from the military. And I had months and months and months kind of like to just do nothing. I mean, I still kind of don't do anything. But I was like, I'm going to watch all of the Star Treks. That was like my goal. I was like, I've watched TNG
back
a bunch
to back
of times.
From TNG, TNG all the way through.
Yeah, that's what I did.
From TOS all the way through.
That's what I did. Like, I watched all of them. The original series is hard to get through, man. It's so slow.
I mean, it's one that I go back every time I don't. Certainly the original series, I don't watch it regularly as more as I do some of the other ones, but I've enjoyed it. You know, some of it, it's obviously very silly based on it's Child of the 60s kind of thing. A lot of the ideas, a lot of the storytelling was way ahead of
absolutely
anything else that was on TV at the time, and a lot of the ideas, you know, obviously were very progressive for the time, and the storytelling was beyond what the medium, the effects and so on, and the budgets could match.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I like to look at that as watching it just with an eye to, like, okay, I can see past the shoddy, wobbly sets and so on.
Right.
I can see that actually the stories you're trying to tell here are really interesting. You're doing some really cool stuff here. You know, and a lot of the things you have to get past are just, you know, the trappings of the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just surface level stuff.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's always my answer to any fictional universe. Obviously, I would live in Star Trek and just hang out and not have to worry about money and
just
exploring.
No money, just have to just go around, travel the galaxy, go to
nice adventures.
Planet. Lovely. Yeah. So, what time period would you pick of which time would you do, Kelvin timeline, or where would you go in this one?
Oh, I don't. The new movies are okay; they're all right. But I'm like TNG, Voyager. Voyager is my favorite series.
I love Voyager, yes.
It's my absolute
Voyager and
favorite
DS9.
DS9. See, I try to get people in the DS. So here's the thing, Graham. I could literally do just a podcast about Star Trek because I could just talk about it like for hours and days. And I tell people, watch DS9, and they're like, oh, it was really slow. And I'm like, have you got past season two? Because
Have you gotten to the war yet?
Yeah, have you got to the Dominion War yet? Oh, no, I don't know what that is. All right, shut up. Sit down. My wife's like, but they're not even on a ship. They don't go on a trek. And Graham, we're watching it. Well, I watch it every night. Like, I watch something Trek every night, and I'm in Deep Space Nine right now. My wife's complaining that they don't go in a starship, and I'm like, okay, cool. And she falls asleep, right? And they introduce the Defiant in this episode. I shake her. I wake her up.
Shake it awake.
I'm like, hey. She's like, what? And I was like, the Defiant's introduced in this episode. It's basically an advanced starship that's made for combat. She's like, why are you waking me up for this? I was like, you said there's no ships on DS9. I just want to point it out.
How long have you known me? What did you think I would do when a spaceship turned up?
So, you know, I had to make sure she knew what was going on. But yeah, Voyager, that would be my favorite. That's the best.
Yeah. Yes, I did enjoy it. I just love I love shows that are like found family kind of things. This is why Firefly appealed to me so much as well. You know, their pilot was called, his name was McNeil, so I kind of bonded with him on that one.
There you go. Good.
And, you know, 7 of 9 didn't hurt either.
You know, that did not hurt. But, you know, I'm glad that actually, I mean, they did do a lot of 7, and this is the last thing I'm going to say about Star Trek for now, but they did do a lot of 7 of 9 centric episodes, but I think as a character, she was actually very well done.
Good. And they did interesting things with her.
Yes.
And she was good as, you know, as she played the hell out of that role.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like anytime, like when she had to play the doctor, when the doctor was like, you know, taking over her body, or whenever she was having the memories of all the different people that they assimilated.
Yeah.
Oh man. Amazing. She was fantastic. Yeah.
Am I right in thinking they're doing, you know, cause obviously she was in Picard as well.
Yeah.
I think they're doing like a spinoff with, or were they not doing it like a, you know, the Rangers show or something like that.
Please.
I think I heard that, whether it's happening or not.
Oh man.
They're COVID wrecked or not. I don't know, but that's right.
Oh gosh. All right.
Great. So yes.
Next question.
Let's move on. Otherwise we'll get Star Trek for the next hour.
Talk about it for hours. You don't even have to be listening. I'll still talk about it. Question number 4, Graham, what inspires you?
What inspires me? My God, that's a broad church of a question. Yeah,
that's what I do here.
Inspires me. I don't even know how to answer that one. I mean, where I get the fuel for telling stories is just, you know, cramming as much input into my brain as I can. You know, I'll watch interesting shows or movies I wouldn't normally pick up, or books. I read all sorts of books, whether it's, you know, fiction, non-fiction, war movies, biography, war memoirs, biographies. I just try and find enough fuel that sparks, you know, inspiration within me. You know, I don't sort of go out and, you know, sit in the hillside and look at the stars to be inspired something. You know, I mean we're in LA, you can't see shit in the sky anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, the light pollution here.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I mean, I try and find it within by just filling my head with enough material that all these kind of different things clash into one another, and there's enough friction between these wildly divergent things that I'm putting into the blender that it actually is, oh yeah, that's kind of cool, but imagine you put that thing with this thing, or that thing came into the mix halfway through, what would that do to it? How would that be a story? Why would that be a character? Just finding ways to make the familiar more interesting. I mean, one of the things I used to do a lot of, you know, many, many years ago when the range was of a scale that you could do this, I used to always do a sort of every now and again a kind of state of the nation in terms of, okay, what characters have we seen a ton of in the books and so on? What settings have we seen a lot of? Where are the gaps? Where have we not been to?
What nations,
what factions have I not tackled? What things have I played it safe with that I could maybe go somewhere interesting now? And that, I always find these are like little storytelling rabbit holes you go down and go, okay, I haven't told an orc story, for example.
Right.
And then I think, okay, well, why? Why do I not? Am I scared of telling an orc story? Do I not really like them that much? Or so I just go down the rabbit hole of finding all the things about whatever it is, and 9 times out of 10, you will find something in there that goes, oh, no, that's cool. That's cool. And that sparks with some other thing that I read 2 weeks ago, or something I've got in my, you know, my Evernote folders are crammed full of little, what about that thing?
Yeah,
and you know, every now and then I'll go back to that and see if anything has resonates. You know, maybe it didn't at the time. I'm like, okay, that's kind of cool, but what does it mean? I don't know. But then when I come up with something else or have another thought that I've had input from somewhere else, now with that in mind, it's like, oh, now that's interesting. What if I combine that with this other thing? So it's providing yourself with enough fodder and fuel that when the spark comes, there's enough there to allow it to become something.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of, you know, my inspiration comes from just finding enough volume of input that when it all clashes together, there's enough there to make something, to make a story, to make a character. And then it's, you know, as you craft one, it sparks to another, and it gradually snowballs again, you know.
Yeah.
So that's how I try and look at it.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's like you have all the ingredients, like the raw ingredients there, and how are you going to mix them together that time?
Because you never know. You know, inspiration is such a nebulous term.
I mean, right. Oh, yeah.
You can never, and I know that's kind of the point of the question, to spark this kind of conversation. You know, it's like, you know, the glib answer that I know some people give is like, well, you know, I go to my bag of inspiring things that I keep inside my desk and I pluck something randomly out. And I never like those answers because they just feel dismissive to the questioner. Sure. It's a serious question. You know, if, you know, depending on the way and the how you're being asked, it's a serious question. Yeah. People want to know, like, you know, wow, where'd you get your ideas from? Or some question of that ilk. And I don't want to disrespect the question and the questioner by being, you know, facetious to them. So it's like I said, I'm repeating myself now, but find all the inputs. And when the inspiration does come, there's the material there.
Yeah. And I think that's interesting. And you know, for me, this is fascinating conversation because I am actually doing a creative writing minor as my degree right now. So I've sat down and they're like, write a story. And I'm like, okay, get inspired, Dan. Like, I'll sit down and I'm like, all right, let's write about something.
Somebody points at you and says, be funny.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's
perform. Perform, monkey.
The tyranny of the blank page. You know, I've worked with a lot of different creatives, artists, musicians, storytellers over the years. And, you know, everybody's different. Some people love that blank page and it's like, okay, the world is my oyster. I can do what I want and bam, 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 off they go.
Yeah.
Others, like myself included, I like to, you know, like just to noodle, to like almost like free write, just ideas, words, concepts, thoughts, and then just wait for something to coalesce out of that. And often, you know, when we have meetings like that at work, it's like, I'm not a big fan of it. It's just like, I don't perform as well in that kind of, okay, go team, brainstorm.
Yeah.
It's like, I like
to come up with something now.
Exactly. I like to fill my notebook with thoughts, ideas, random quotes, blah, blah, blah. And then that will gradually, you know, that lump in clay can get turned into something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, it strikes and works differently for everybody. That's just my way of doing it.
I really love that idea of, like you said, you kind of like put down, what have I already done?
Yeah.
And then you go, where's those little gaps? Because I find that I'm also like writing the same things, like, but just in a different color, you know, like,
That's exactly why in the day I wrote the Ambassador books, because I was seeing, okay, well, we've barely done anything in Kislev for one thing.
Yeah.
And I think there was only, I think it was Beast Slayer, Bill King wrote, was the only book that we'd done in Kislev. It's like, okay, that's cool. And all the characters we had at that point were kind of big, tough, grizzled warrior types, warrior priests, bounty hunters, those few things. And they were all cool characters. But I just thought, you know, I've written a whole bunch of those kind of characters and everybody else has. So what haven't we done? So I was like, okay, well, why not do an old boy, an old guy at the end of his career, put out to pasture, so to speak. That's not something we've seen before. And Kislev, okay, that's not a setting we've seen before.
Yeah.
How could that work? What story could that be? Why would an old guy be sent to Kislev? And, you know, lots of questions. I was like, my notepads are, you would think, you know, it would be like some interrogator's notes you were getting if you looked at my notebooks, because it's full of questions. I mean, that's how I often build out a story. Why is he going there? What does what does she want? Yeah. What is the matter with this person? What happens if they fail? What happens if they succeed? What is it? You know, it's just all the questions that drive me to think, what's the most interesting way I can answer that? Because if at any point the reader, the viewer, whatever, is looking at your work and saying, but why don't they just you failed at something, you know, if there's a more obvious way of doing things, you've got to find out, okay, what is the way that I can force these people into making the worst choice imaginable and think it's great?
Right.
And that's always the way that for me that I drive, you know, let the characters drive the story on to the next level. Because I don't, you know, I, you know, yes, you can put in like tentpole moments of, okay, there's the big siege of such and such, or there's the big battle here, or whatever, whatever the moment is, you know, it's the big tentpole moment of the story. But I try not to say, okay, well, I'm railroading my characters there. It's like, okay, how can I, what roadblocks, what terrible decisions can I put in their path that would drive them to that point naturally, where I can have my cake and eat it, where I get the big moment that I want to tell. but it feels naturalistic that the characters have got there. You know, they're always the first point of call in the story, the first thing that drives us to where we need to go to for the story.
I think that's, I mean, I also like the idea that, you know, in this, your example, like, I can't necessarily relate to, like, these big, strong, grizzled guys, but I can relate to being, like, an old guy that's at the end of my career kind of thing. You know, it's like, okay, and as soon as you said that, I was like, oh, I want to read that story because, that, you know, when I retired from the military, that's how I felt. They're like, all right, well, yeah. Thanks for playing. You're out. You know what I mean?
Service. Bye.
Yeah.
I mean, I think those moments are the great entry points for a story, you know, like coming to a character in crisis. Because that's, you know, character is revealed through crisis. You know, a fictional character's character is revealed through crisis. You know, it's our job as writers to put them in the worst position, possible positions, so that the decisions they make are driven by action, driven by, if I don't make a call here, terrible things will happen.
Yeah.
And you always, you know, for the most part, until the, you know, the character's gone through their, you know, emotional arc and learned the things they need to learn, almost all of these decisions will be really bad.
Right. Just like my real life.
Like, what am I writing? Fiction, nonfiction?
Let's talk about hobby one more time.
Yeah.
What is your advice for someone getting into the hobby?
Again, a tricky one, because I've been so steeped in it all my life, I don't remember a time when I haven't had paints or paintbrushes on the go. How I would say to somebody, I mean, nowadays, it's I think it's probably far easier.
Back in the day, we had to, like, look in a book or buy magazines, and now I can literally go to YouTube and find out how to do anything.
How to play, how to paint.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
And the Games Workshop, I mean, the Games Workshop in Glasgow that I sort of learned in, the folks there were fantastic. They, you know, absolutely, they welcomed everybody in, got the games going, and, you know, they built that excitement. I think that, because I've been through something of that journey with Evan, my son, because he's
very cool.
He's 11. He's coming up to 12 now, and I know obviously
that's the age.
He's been surrounded by it since he was born. You know, it's the house has been filled with models and books, and Daddy's been writing his books and stuff. And when we lived in England, we lived, I think, maybe 4-5 miles from Warhammer World.
Nice.
So it was his swimming lessons when he was very young were literally a couple hundred yards from Warhammer World. So I would take him to swimming lessons every Saturday, and then we'd nip into Warhammer World and just, you know, show him the, you know, the scale, the grandeur of the tables, the gaming hall and stuff like that. But I was very careful not to try and push it.
Right.
Because I thought, you know, if he's going to kind of come to this, he's going to come to it organically.
Right.
If I push it on him, he's just going to go, Dad, what's going to do this thing? So, you know, you would sort of leave codexes lying around or models, stuff, you know, all these sort of things that would, like, trip up interest and so on. So, yeah, I think imparting the love of the hobby, I think, is the first part, you know, like, because when we first played games, you know, there was no rules. I would just, oh, you roll that dice, this is how many units you move, and, you know, oh, you roll a 4+, you've killed my guy, woohoo! You know, it was total freeform stuff, but it imparted a level of excitement, a level of, this is fun, actually, you know, I get to roll dice and I knocked your guy over and vice versa, and I can move this tank over here. So he got the fun way, you know, years before I started, you know, saying, okay, well, you have to use this tape measure now, and this is how far this model can go. And same with painting, when we first did some models, you know, it took every ounce of my willpower to sort of let him do his own thing with a model. No, paint that bit red there. No, that bit. No, just give me the brush. You know, and you're like, no, this is his model. Let him do what he wants. So that learn the feel of it, the how to use a brush. Let him figure it out on his own. And he's there, man. We're painting the Indomitus Necrons just now, and he's been telling me all about his faction, who they are, what their colors are, and why they're this, and so on. I'm like, it's one of us now.
Yes. Fingers together. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the store, you know, like the guys and girls in the stores are great. Yeah. They know exactly how to do that much better than I can. You know, intro games, painting intros.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I remember, you know, like way back in the day, you know, the stores used to be motivated by sheer volume. How much can you sell? Sell. Whereas they understand a lot. I mean, even when I was still there, they understood this and were beginning to shift to the model, which is much more, which is entirely prevalent now, of we're building hobbyists. We're building future and continued hobbyists now. So it's not about sale. I mean, sure, if somebody buys a box set of something, that's fantastic. That's exactly what you want. But you want to cultivate the love of the hobby. Right. So yeah, go to a store, paint a miniature, play a demo game, try your hand at painting, have a game with somebody, and you know, if all goes well, then you're a hobbyist and you will get lifetime's enjoyment out of it.
You got them. You know, I did I was teaching 40K intro games at, oh boy, what's the huge con that's in Indianapolis? Gen Con.
Gen Con?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a couple of years ago I was doing this. And I have a couple that came and they were like, yeah, we've been thinking about it. So I teach them the game. And that was when it was the new Death Guard had just come out. You know, we still had Disgustingly Resilient. Yep, we still had Disgustingly Resilient, which is like the best rule ever in the whole world. Oh, yep. But I get one more save, you know. So his guy's wife is playing, and she's super excited to be the Death Guard. And so I was like, every time I roll Disgusting Resilient, you know, I would just be like, oh, Disgusting Resilient, don't forget Disgusting Resilient. We're yelling, Disgusting Resilient, like, and people around us are like turning around, like, are you guys okay? And we're just cracking up and we're laughing super hard because she stomped her husband, like she stomped this guy so bad. And every time she's like, Disgustingly Resilient, and she's like flopping the dice hard, right? And she actually shot it out on Twitter like a day or two later, and she said this was the most fun we had the entire Gen Con, was playing this demo game, nice, Lonely Havocs. And I think that's probably like the best compliment like I've maybe probably ever received in the hobby. And I was just like, man, that's wow. I hope they're still playing, because she was just having the best time. He was getting his butt kicked, so I don't know how much fun he was having, but she was going crazy.
Seeing her having fun hopefully gave him, you know, a real buzz of fun.
But yeah, I get that, you know, and I always try to get people, like I play at my local store, which is not a Games Workshop, but it's a very nice big local store, and people kind of poke their head into the game room. I'm like, come in, yes, join us.
It's all harmless. Come in.
Yes.
You wouldn't leave down here. Miniatures in your arm, I promise.
So yeah, I love that take on it, that it's all about developing the love more than developing the skill.
The rules will come later.
It comes later.
You know, if you try and go hard on that up front, you'll just turn people away.
Scare people away. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I got to paint it like the back of the box. That's not going to happen.
Exactly. Well, I've had plenty of games of Kill Team and stuff over the lockdown, because Evan and I have been playing it. So
yeah.
You know, basically, I'm just crafting an opponent so I wouldn't go out of my mind over the last year and a half.
You don't have to ever leave the house.
Exactly.
That's kind of my
Although,
goal.
Although, we tried to go to the opening of the new Warhammer Store Cafe yesterday in Rovia in LA, but it's insanely queued.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought, we can't wait 8 hours in a queue.
No, thanks.
But, you know, we stuck about in the queue for a little while, and we were just... Again, it's one of the things that I love about the community. It's like we were just sat in the queue, the line, talking to everybody behind us, in front of us, and just talking away about the hobby and the games we've had. And Evan was telling them all about his faction story.
It's very cool.
This guy's girlfriend was talking about how she's into Death Guard and how why and so on. It was great. We didn't get into the store, but it was still a lovely hobby community kind of day.
Still a nice experience.
And we left the queue, went to go for lunch at the nearby bar. And you could tell it was all the people who'd given up in the queue. Just all these Aquilas and everybody's back and Games Workshop cases beside them. And we were chatting away to some folk next door at the table. It was good. It was fun. Fun day out, actually. Awesome. For one that was actually a failure on the intent, it was actually a fun day.
That's the best kind of days, the ones you don't expect.
Yeah.
So, Graham, do you have any odd rituals or superstitions?
In general or with the hobby?
It could be the hobby, it could be in general. Whatever you feel like sharing, man.
No, my superstitions tend towards more my writing in terms of there are certain kinds of notepad that I like and use all the time when I'm sketching out, you know, ideas and plots and stuff like that, or chapter plans. There's certain pen types, you know, I'll using a blue ink to write ideas and stuff down. Madness. That's like the ideas don't count unless they're in black ink. and I always I every time I start a page, you know, it's, I write the thing, you know, the such and such scene, whatever it is.
Yeah.
A little rectangle around it in black, then another one in red, and I always use the same kind of red pen for editing, and I always have to print it out to edit it old school by hand rather than doing it on screen. I have spent fruitfully days getting the exact, okay, this is the formatting for this book. Okay, it's going to be this font for the chapter headings, this spacing for the chapters, you know, just the whole layout of a thing, you know, it's stupid because, you know, it makes no difference because it's going to get sent to the editor and then
they're going to do, yeah,
cut and pasted straight into another template for an EPUB or something. But I can't start a book until I've got everything just so, you know, my margin, I have a template for most of it, but each book takes its own, has its own character, its own flavor of how am I going to lay this one out? How am I going to, what font am I going to use for the chapters or the title and so on? So that's a silly one, frankly, but it's one that I keep to.
I like that. There's a sense of comfort in that kind of thing.
Yeah, I feel I'm ready then. You know, I've done the necessary groundwork to get the book ready to be coined.
I mean, why screw with the process if it's working, is what I always say.
I always, you know, there's that scene in Kevin Costner movie, Bull Durham, the baseball one.
Yeah.
When he's berating Susan Sarandon, and he's saying, you know, if he's out there and he's hitting the well because he's got lucky pants on or lucky shoes or a lucky baseball or he's wearing women's underpants, then he is, and you don't mess with that.
You don't.
That's exactly it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Yeah, and you know, and I think there's a certain, like, there's a value to believing in, like, something lucky because it's just like a positive. You give yourself this positive vibe
for success. You know,
yeah, it really does.
If I'm not doing these things, there's, even if it makes no impact on the final thing, you know, realistically, in my head, I'm thinking I haven't done the thing. This bit isn't quite right, and it's obviously it's not even close to the levels of, you know, like OCD or anything like that. But these are the things that I like. I like what I like, and I like it in the right place at the right time and the right setting. And same with, you know, with painting and hobbying. I don't know if that's a superstition or just good sense or whatever, but I always do the bases last. You know, if the base.
Doesn't everybody do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. That's why I'm not sure if that's a superstition or just like, yeah.
I don't know.
Of course you would do the base last.
Like the rim around the edge of the base is always last for me.
Absolutely.
Like, that's the last step.
When that's done, you know, the model's there.
Yeah, it's completed. It's done.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think there's a lot to be said about, like, how you're saying, I like the things that I like and I like them in a certain way. And I think, like, in general, as human beings, if we can be more honest about the things that we like and just saying, yeah, this is just how I like to do it. Like, sorry, like, if it's weird to you or whatever, this is how I like it and this is how I'm going to do it. So.
Even models that I've got a separate base, that, you know, like Gulliman's base, you know, I was like, I'm not going to paint that while he's on it. So I had, you know, the model disassembled and on pins and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But even then, I was like, I should do the base first so that once I do I'll do the legs, then I'll stick it on there, then I'll do his torso and stick it on top of that. And it's like, nope. I had to do all the bits of Gulliman first. Once he was all painted, then I went back and did the base. So even then, I couldn't do the base first.
No, it would just feel wrong.
It does. It's just, you know, the natural order of things is violated.
It'd feel like, you ever put, like, if you're like me, you put it I put my right shoe on first every time. And there's been times where I've maybe put my left shoe on because I couldn't find the other one, and then I had to take the left shoe off to put the right one on. And I'm being 100% honest with you here, man, because, like, I was like, oh, that's fucking weird. Like, I can't do that, so let me take the shoe off.
That's a little bit weird, but I totally get where you're coming from.
I hope, you know, if not, that's cool too.
in terms of personal foibles we have, that's pretty low on the list of, you know, negative impacts on the world and people around you.
Like, it's not
nobody's hurt by the order of your shoe putting on.
Is, you know, not that I know of. I mean,
well, you know,
we'll see. Time will tell, Grant.
The tiny communities within your shoe and on the base of it. Like, no, but this.
So, Graham, what is your official or unofficial life motto?
I don't like to say them particularly much, but I always liked the motto for the Royal Society in London of Nullius in Verba, which is question everything. So I quite like that one.
Yeah.
Or what's that? And, well, there's also, I mean, like the Iron Code of Druss from David Gemmell's books. Well, he's, you know, I have a painting of him on my wall beside me. And his one, you know, Drust the Legend was like David Gemmell's most, he's his signature character, mm-hmm. you know, this great big, you know, 60-year-old warrior who stood in the walls of Drost Delnoch and defied the Nadir. And he had his quote of, you know, never violate a woman nor harm a child. Do not lie, cheat, or steal. These things are for lesser men. Protect the weak against the evil strong and never allow thoughts of gain to lead you into pursuit of evil. That's okay. What it is. It's written on a little plaque underneath the painting, and I think that's words to live by.
That is words to live by.
Or, you know, and again, there's in David Gemmell's books, there's the Nadir, who were like, in the first book, in Legend, they were kind of like the barbarous savages at the gates kind of uh-huh. thing. But
yeah.
The more the books developed, the more they became, you know, actual, you know, a culture, a noble culture, the, you know, savage and ferocious, but a culture worthy of celebrating in song and story and so on. And they had one, you know, I can't remember what they called it particularly. It wasn't a battle cry, it was like a, you know, a mantra almost of like, Nadir, we axe wielders, victors still. And I thought that's quite good. That's cool. Summed them up nicely.
That's cool. There's a, so I lived in Italy for a little bit back in the day when I was in the military. And one that always stuck with me is Al cane al lupo, which is into the jaws of the wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other person, it's basically the other person says crepi, which means may they choke, which I always thought was really cool. So, like, you know, if you're going to go through a bad situation, you make the most of it kind of thing. And that one always kind of stuck with me, too. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I've got a lot of ones that have come out of my readings of Jocko Willink. He's got a good line and of just not fatalistic, but, you know, just whenever it's like somebody's presenting me with there's a problem's come up, and so I was like, no factor. Oh, this thing's collapsing around you. No factor. You just, you know, it's my way of almost like compartmentalizing it to say, okay, that's happened.
Yeah.
We'll deal with it.
It's not a problem.
Yeah, exactly. No factor. Discipline equals freedom.
So, Graham, what's a game you've been wanting to play?
The one I'm most looking forward to these days is Horizon Forbidden West on the PlayStation. I loved Horizon Zero Dawn. I thought that was a wonderful game in terms of everything about it. You know, how it looked, how it played, the gameplay, the story, the characters, the emotions that I did not expect to feel playing a game like that.
Right. Yeah.
And even because they were all generated through like the, you know, without spoiling it for anybody, but when you get to the end of towards the end of the game,
yeah,
when you start picking up like the voice logs of the people who were on the Zero Dawn project, and you realize why the world is the way it is and what happened and their thoughts and feelings about confronting the end of the world. It was very, very touching and very, very emotional, which I did not expect. And it was just a great game. So I cannot wait to play Forbidden West and get back into that world. As far as tabletop goes, there's a game called Oathsworn Into the Deepwood coming out. It was a Kickstarter game that I
haven't seen it.
It's one of these games. It's like kind of like a, in some ways similar, like there's a Gloomhaven aspect to it.
Okay.
You know, it's a storytelling game where you make choices during the course of the game, and like you're in a city map and you're investigating a thing, and as you come to the culmination of the story, you then move to another map where it's like a tabletop war game with a big monster and your characters, your little party, and you progress through the story game from, you know, game to game to game to game. And, you know, originally back, you know, when it was first sort of on or coming to Kickstarter, you know, I was in conversation with the guys that were making it, and, you know, I played a early playtest of it and loved it, thought it was great.
It's really cool.
And I was going to do some work on the game, but just time and a whole bunch of other things meant I couldn't get to spend any time to work on it as much as it would have needed. So, but I've been following the progress of the game through Kickstarter, and the sheer amount of miniatures that are in that game, and they're fabulous looking miniatures, and the gameplay, because it speaks to that storytelling aspect that I love, And that sort of legacy thing where, you know, you pack it away one day, then they come back the next and carry on the story, really appeals to me. So that's one I'm really looking forward to playing.
That'd be awesome. So, you know, if anyone that listens to my podcast knows that I like video games, but I'm not particularly good at video games. Like, I'm old and slow, and, you know, like, it takes me a minute. And but
one eye and three fingers.
Yeah. It just, you know, I can't see. Things move too fast. I don't understand the language. But anyway, it's the. Have you ever played the Knights of the Old Republic, the Star Wars?
Yeah. I played the first two, the one and two. Yeah.
So and before this time, you know, I hadn't really considered video games as really like this. I don't want to say valid storytelling medium, but like I never really thought I would be changed by playing a video game. In that first Knights of the Old Republic, like, it blew me absolutely away, and I was like, this is like deeply affecting me. And, you know, I played like a light side version and I played a dark side version, and the dark side version, at some point you have to like kill off some of the people that have been in your group for the whole time. And I'm like, I don't want to do this.
No,
like, I'm
like, I have this exact same thing when I played the second one first. I was back, I was still at workshop at the time. And I said to the guys were looking to get me something. I was like, do not get me Knights of the Old Republic. It looks so good, but it looks like a game that I will absolutely sink into, and I've got deadlines to hit, so don't get me it. Which you can see where this is going. So of course
they had it for you.
I get? And I played it, and I was like, oh my god, this is so good. I mean, this story is amazing. I love it. Darth Revan thing, and it's like, who are you? And I'm like you. I games where there are moral choices to make, I find it very difficult to pick the bad one.
Yeah,
first time I played Bioshock, and it was like, oh, I'll get more Adam if I suck it out the little girl. Okay, we'll do that. And then when the animation plays out, and you're like, well, okay, I'm never doing that again. And same, yeah, I played the light side. I played a Jedi, and then for the completeness of the play experience, oh, I'll play as a Sith. Go that way. Yeah. And I think I got halfway through it, and it was like, yeah, I don't like doing this. You know, even you know, they're not real, they're pixels. I still don't.
I feel terrible.
A balcony and doing stuff, bad stuff. You know, and now, you know, with like my kids, is like, especially my daughter, something. Even like we were playing the Uncharted games, which I absolutely love. And there's bits in it where like you have to kill a particular beast, you know, a giant. Sure. Boars or wolves or a jaguar if you're in the jungle or something like that, and you can't progress unless you do that. And she threw an absolute hissy fit with me because I killed this. She loves animals.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm like hacking this animal with a knife to death. She's like, you ain't do up your little animal. I was like, oh, so I don't like being the bad guy in games.
No. So
the things like, as much as I, as a technical achievement, and I absolutely adored The Last of Us 2. You know, again, without spoiling the game, it makes you do some really terrible things as Ellie, and it doesn't give you a choice in the matter. Like this one bit where it's like you've got to beat this person to death with an iron rod, and the game just sits there waiting for you to continually tap X.
Yeah.
Like, do that. But that's... And it's like, okay, well, I'm not playing as me, I'm playing as Ellie, and she's traumatized and yada yada. Yeah. But then the game made me feel bad for it. It's like looking at me going, oh man, that terrible bad thing you did. Oh, I can't believe you did that. I'm like, you wouldn't let me do anything else but
I didn't have a choice.
Yes. So, but yeah, that, I mean, again, The Last of Us, the first Last of Us was brilliant. I love it. I mean, the ending when you're playing as Joel fighting to get to the hospital room, oh man, I was in bits trying to get there at the end.
Yeah.
And second one, I didn't have as much of an experience of that, but it's still a wonderful, tremendous game.
Man.
But yeah, storytelling in that is, and I can't miss it. I can't wait for the TV show adaptation of it.
Oh goodness, I didn't know they were going to make a show.
Pedro Pascal's playing Joel. And
he's on fire right now.
He can do no wrong, that man.
He's on fire. Yeah, I love that guy.
I forget the name of the girl, but it's the one that played the little Mormont leader in.
Oh yeah, yes. Yeah.
Let's not even start
talking about that. I'll go on another tangent.
We'll have another mad tangent.
That's what we do here. Next question. Have you ever disliked something and then changed your mind about it?
Don't think so. I mean, there's been a few. Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of, couple of bands I wasn't particularly fond of, but then when I actually gave them a chance and listened to them, I was like, oh yeah, no, you know, I really like that. Mm-hmm. But nothing springs to mind.
Nothing major.
I mean, there's a couple of, when I first started playing Assassin's Creed, I mean, I'm a huge Assassin's Creed fan. I've got, you can't see it, but you know, behind my computer there, there's about 10, the 10-inch tall Assassin's Creed figurines from all the different adventures. And I did not like Origins when I first played it, because I just thought, this is the progression, this is all messed up, I hate it, I don't like it, it's the scenery's all really bland, and just bloody deserts all the time. But then I played Odyssey, and I realized, I realized what I was doing wrong now with Origins, and then went back to it, and we played it all through to the end, and it's now one of my favorites, actually, because I love, Bayek and Aya are two of my favorite of the Assassins. Thing I can think of. I mean,
but that's pretty major, though. Like, this game sucks. Like, why am I playing this? Oh, my perspective was a little different.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. I was essentially playing it wrongly. I wasn't like holding the controller upside down or anything like that. But I was going to, places where, it was like Roman garrisons. Oh, I can do this, and then the Roman sentry would just sort of look at me, and I would die.
Right.
Jump off a roof with a sword and plunge it down through his skull, and it'd be like, is that the best you've got, mate? No. And it's like, this is so unbalanced. Then I was like, because the way the level progression works in starting with Origins, and they've used since then, was very different from the previous games. So, and I was playing it like a previous game, not making any allowance for the way progression is measured in this game has changed, but I have not, and I will not change, and so this game sucks.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, wait, oh, I get it now. That's actually good.
That's how I am with every game. It's like, oh, I'm supposed to sneak around and not be seen? No, I'm just going to run up on people and shoot
at charge people.
Exactly.
Lancelot.
Oh, how do I keep... yes. How do I keep losing this game?
There's nothing else I can think of, particularly that I've started, not liked, and then come back to or something. I don't know, there's probably... I don't know, there's maybe a couple of TV shows or something that I can't think of offhand that people have said, oh, stick with it, go back and try it again, and I've watched it and enjoyed, but I can't think of any offhand.
Cool. So if you could play a game with anyone, who would it be and what game would you play?
I'd love to play some old school D&D with Gary Gygax.
Oh, that'd be cool. The man himself.
Yeah. just to see, how did you envisage this playing? Obviously role playing has, changed a lot since, the first games came out, but I'd love to see what was your initial vision of what this game would be? I think that'd be pretty awesome.
And I got to tell you, I love role playing games. Like, that's one of my most favorite things. I'm the forever GM though. Like, when I do get to play, it's few and far between, and I don't mind it so much, but I am in a D&D campaign with some friends of mine. I'm not huge, Graham, I'm not huge on like fantasy settings, so it's like hard for me to like really get into it. I'm like a sci-fi guy, like hardcore through and through. And I'm like, is there lasers? Can I be a robot? And they're like, oh, you can be this Warforged. It's kind of like a robot. And I'm like, all right, sign me up, bro. I'll be a
steampunk golem type thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I'm this dude. I'm like, I don't eat, I don't sleep, whatever. I don't care. But it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I've been a long time Cthulhu keeper. That's my go to setting if I want to, really get under the skin of my players. It's Cthulhu is my jam for that. The 1920s. I've run a couple of really long campaigns. One in New Orleans and one in San Francisco, and they were a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, and that's New Orleans is like the perfect place for that. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Creepy down there, man.
I tried to stay away from too many cliches or too many things that would be, problematic for white guy to do set down there, and I think we did it okay. I mean, it was fun. Yeah. It was disturbing in all kinds of creepy ass ways, I have a framed picture sat in the wall behind me of the king in yellow, because he was the ultimate villain of that campaign. Yeah. And we finished I finished running that one literally like 5 days before we all moved to the States.
Oh, very cool.
So, you know, all the guys that were in my group, all the folk there, they all signed around the edge of the painting with a little thing. So it's just,
and that was the send-off, man.
Yeah, exactly. The frame is, we carefully chose the frame to, so it wasn't too modern. It looked like it had, you know, something that had been hidden under sheeting in the attic of some forgotten house for 50 years kind of thing. And it looks like it's antique, but still got a slight modern twist to it, but it looks good.
I like it.
And it's certainly one, you know, when people come around, if they look in the house, you know, because the other paintings are, you know, relatively speaking, fairly conventional.
Right, yeah.
And then people look at that and they go, what the fuck?
Yeah, but what am I staring at here?
Yeah. And, you know, and you can see them taking the sand check as they stand there watching.
Have you tried the Star Wars Fantasy Flight RPG?
No, I haven't.
Oh, that is my all-time favorite one.
I love Star Wars, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm a big Star Wars nerd, and that was, that's my comfort film. It's one I go back to a lot, the original trilogy and so on. But I've never fancied role-playing in that universe. You know, 40K, I've done that. Star Trek, done that. I like the look of the new Dune RPG. But Star Wars, I don't know. I've never really thought of it as one to play in.
For me, it's just a case of, like, you know, instead of doing well in school, I just know a lot about Star Wars, you know? So, like, it's, for me, it's like, I know everything about Star Wars. Hit me with it. What do you want? What are we going to do? Like, I can explain
how everything... That's not a marketable skill when you're looking for an accountant. What?
It might be. I wish it was. Like, you know, and I love playing with people that don't have a lot of, you know, knowledge of the Star Wars universe, because I'm just, like, dazzling them with all these factoids and things that they don't know.
Well, that was the great thing. The campaign, the New Orleans set campaign ran, two of the guys in there had no knowledge of anything about the Mythos. I mean, they didn't even know that something called the Mythos existed.
Yeah, yeah.
They're just like, oh, this is Call of Cthulhu, what's that? Oh, it's, you know, they knew role-playing, and so on. One of them had never role-played before, the other one had, but they didn't know anything about H.P. Lovecraft or the Mythos, so, you know, and the other two guys who did know about that, they're great, great players who knew exactly, you know, that dividing line between what I know and what my character knows, and playing the character accordingly. So they were essentially my accomplices, almost, because the guys who didn't know anything about it were, you could see them gradually, you know, come to the realization that, wait a minute, what the hell is going on here?
You were
drip feeding the little bits of horror and the cranking up the atmosphere, cranking up the dread to the point where they were like, this is scaring the crap out of me. What the hell is going on here? And, you know, because they just thought it was like a sort of 20s pulp detective kind of role play thing. So when the more fantastical, you know, mind-bending elements came in, just to see that in a player's face when, because most people know something of the setting when they go in it, but these guys, they knew nothing.
Watching that
was a joy to behold. Yeah, one of my favorite role-playing experiences is seeing that creeping realization of what was happening sweeping over them. Is like, oh, that's great. That's good. That's fun.
Everything's not what it seems around here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I like that. So, you know, in history, Graham, there's BC and there's AD, right? Yeah.
And so BC, you know.
Yeah, so what marks your life's passage from your BC to your AD?
The Cambrian explosion was, I think, when I got the copy of the Warlock of Firetop Mountain. Because that was my first step into a larger world.
yes.
I think my second one was obviously picking up that copy of White Dwarf that had the advert for the staff writer in it, because, you know, the trajectory of where my life was going at that point was, you know, not one I think I'd be looking back at now going, wow, that was a hell of a time, you know, the things I have done, the places I have been, the people I have met have been stunningly varied, diverse and interesting. Whereas from the moment I picked up that article and came to Nottingham to work at Games Workshop, you know, my life, you know, wildly veered hard right. I think of all the people I've met, all the places I've been, all the stories I've told since then, and it's like, wow. You know, as Jim Morrison said, it's the strangest life I've ever known.
Right. You know, and I like that answer because usually people say, oh, whenever I got married, and I'm like, oh, your wife's not listening. It's okay.
These are great moments. But, you know, from the moment we met, it was like, you know, you know, looking back, obviously, you could see the sort of progression along the way to the moments that we, you know, birth of the children, getting married and so
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah.
But none of them, I mean, those, like I said to the kids before, is like, if I hadn't been, because I met my wife in London while I was down doing a book signing, and okay. I went out with the guys from the Games Workshop store. We went out for a few pints afterwards. I was staying down in London that night, and she lived in Bristol, which is, you know, quite a ways from London as well, and I lived in Nottingham, yeah, which is quite a ways from London, but we both happened to be in London at that night particularly, and in this, yeah, particular bar and so on. So I keep telling them, like, if it wasn't for 40k and gaming, I wouldn't have been there in London. I wouldn't have met Mum, and you guys wouldn't be here. So I you know, it's like everything, there's never one root cause. There's always something, right, behind that and behind that and behind that and so on. But those two moments particularly are moments I can, even now looking to some of them, like one when I was 11, I can picture exactly. There was a place called the Mulgai Bookshop inside Glasgow, yeah, but it was near the edge of the city. I can remember the number of aisles in the store. I remember the books. I remember the placement. I remember the guy that sold me the book. Everything about that day is just etched in my mind completely. I think that has to be a moment that, you know, either my subconscious or whatever knew that was an important moment. Yeah, and that was special. You're going to want to remember this. You're going to read in years to come. You're going to look back in this moment as a moment where your life took a turn that was important. You know, every day you make a million decisions, but that was one, you know, like Doctor Who would say, that's a fixed moment in time, you know, a moment there that the hinge of somebody's life just turns completely. And that was one of them. And, you know, going down to, you know, seeing that magazine article advertising the job in Nottingham was another one.
That's awesome. That's why I like to ask this kind of question, because I feel like everybody has one of those kind of moments. And if the people that don't have that answer, I'm like, maybe you haven't had that moment yet, you know, because you know it.
You know it. I mean, that's the thing. I think sometimes, and I don't want to say the skill as if it's like something, you know, that I was skilled at notes, but I think you're some part of you knows or can sense it, or some part of you not want to sense it, but if you're aware enough of the moment, of being in the moment enough, you can sense this is something important here going on here. And like that moment when I picked up that book, I knew, I don't know why, I don't know how, but I knew something, yeah, was, this is a fundamental moment of change that is coming.
I love that. So what is something that you wished you had learned sooner?
I'd love to have sooner. You know, learn to put your ego in check.
Because a good thing to learn. Times,
it is a very good thing, and it's still an ongoing thing. You know,
yeah,
it's not a sort of thing that you ever just say, hey, I've done it, man. I'm there. I'm sorted.
Ego's good. Got it worked out.
Exactly. It's in check. I am cool, calm, and collected at all times. I never make any mistakes or decisions based on emotion. Yeah, right.
Never.
Because yeah, I mean, I still am kind of an emotionally driven kind of person, but I think I've gotten better at tempering that and not getting rid of it, because I think, you know, you don't want to become a robot.
No, it's important.
I think a lot of the decisions I made and the ways I reacted to things when I was, you know, younger, less experienced, whatever, were very much driven by the emotion of the moment. Whenever the thing, whatever it was, occurred,
yeah,
you know, I would kind of react instantly or instinctively, as opposed to coming at it from, okay, I'm feeling this way, but if I can take 5 seconds to think about this,
right,
I can feel the emotion, acknowledge it, and then make a decision that is less just, you know, visceral is the one I was looking for.
Oh, visceral's good
too. Me writer, use words good. but, you know, that's the thing, you know, like just, and a lot of, you know, like the no factor thing. It sounds glib, but yeah, so many of the things that my younger self thought were, it's the end of the world if this thing changes. Yeah. You realize now, actually, no, it wasn't. You know, it doesn't mean anything. That thing that is so important to you back then, it's not really that important. And, you know, there's no, because everything we do in life, it comes down to relationships. You know, the successes we have are through good relationships we have built with our friends, with our co-workers, with clients, whatever. And nothing, you know, it's not worth damaging them. And, you know, unless something's so egregious that, yeah, that's, you're out of line and that's yeah, illegal.
We're done.
And that's, yeah. In five states, you'd get the death penalty for that or whatever. You know, but there's almost nothing that is worth that level of, you know, reputational or relationship damage. So a lot of times I can be more sanguine about things now, but I certainly was not when I was younger.
Yeah. And I think it's so much easier, like, I don't know if easier is the word. It's more common for you to like stress yourself out about situations that you can't change because you haven't quite learned that this, you just can't change it. Like that's how it is, man.
some of it is, you know, I probably, you know, it's of age and experience sort of thing. And some of it is becoming, I think, maybe a little more self-aware in terms of who I am, you know, understanding myself better and knowing the ways I react to things or the ways I typically dealt with things and realizing that actually that probably wasn't the best way to have done it. You know, being aware of your own failings or being aware of just who you are.
Yeah,
is something that is, you know, very useful. You know, that emotional intelligence to understand. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm maybe not really good at this, but I can get better, or I should have responded to that in a different way. And being able to be vulnerable in that respect of, you know, because that's, you know, that's a lot of people think of being vulnerable as being weak, but actually, you know, being able to be vulnerable to somebody is actually a strength, I think, because it helps build the trust, it helps build the relationship.
Yeah. And I think there's something to be said about people that are able to be introspective about themselves and then also be honest about how they are. Like, yeah, I've thought about it.
Half is an important part. I didn't mention that. It's, you know, you can acknowledge these truths about yourself, but being honest enough to say, I was a dick then or whatever, is
suck at this.
And I guess I say it, don't get me wrong, I'm not like some sitting in a rock zen master.
You know,
I
was getting those vibes
out, stressed out about all these things, but I'm better than I was, certainly.
This is an important question because I see this a lot on social media because, you know, obviously I'm on the thing all the time because it's 2021 and I'm an adult.
That's where we live.
That's where we live. But imposter syndrome, have you ever had it? If you have, how did you work through it? What do you do?
I mean, I think every creative has it at some point or continues to live with it. I mean, I've certainly had moments, ongoing moments where it's like, why am I even doing this? It's like, this is just garbage.
Right.
I'm, you know, blessed, cursed with a healthy ego, which is, you know, why it's sometimes hard to put it in check. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, a lot of people say, oh, my first draft, I know it's, you know, they call their first draft the barf draft. I know it's going to be terrible. I'm just going to get the words out and then I can fix it afterwards. And I'm probably one of the few, but I feel I might be who my first draft and I produce it, I'm like, that's all right, actually. You know, I think you've got to have a level of confidence in your own abilities to do anything creative because you're going to put it out there in the world and everybody's going to see it and they're going to like it or not like it, judge it or ignore it. So I think you have to have a healthy level of ego to do anything creative. But it's like everything else. It needs to be in balance. You know, if you have too much ego, then you can become an insufferable arse. If you have not enough ego, then you'll never publish anything because you're too afraid of what the reaction might be.
Right,
I've spoken to people at every end of the spectrum, you know, from like creatives who write and draw art, who make art. And it's like, you're on a slippery slope here of thinking that you can't ever get better. And that's dangerous for any creative. But then by the same token, I've seen people who are so afraid of the reaction to their work that they never put anything out there. It's like, I've got 10 unfinished stories. Well, why have you never finished them? Well, because if I finish them, I'll have to show them to people. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's almost like a self-defense mechanism where they don't finish a thing because then they don't have to show you it. Or they endlessly refine a thing because it's not quite ready, and you know it never will be ready.
It's
and
never ready. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of those types of conversations. I mean, certainly they fed into a lot of the subtext within the novel Fulgrim about perfection and when is it ready? When do you have to show it to somebody? Mm. And when can you? And what does that mean to your psyche when you think it's ready but it's not, and so on and so forth. But yeah, I mean, there's all. I think a little bit of imposter syndrome is healthy. Because you need to, you know, I like to remind myself that there's always something new to learn. There's always a new way of doing things that could be better. You know, that's why I love chatting to other creatives and hearing about their process and their techniques. And, you know, whenever the Black Library writers have got together at, you know, the weekenders or events and so on, we end up, you know, we all go out for dinner at some point, we're chatting away, and, you know, every single one of us has got a different process.
Yeah.
And I've learned something new about how to, you know, manage and wrangle the creative work by talking to, you know, to Gab or to Guy or to Aaron, to Dan and so on, and Jim. They've all had little nuggets here and there that have gone, oh, actually, you know what, that's really good.
Yeah.
And
so I'm going to take that, yeah.
Exactly. So it's all, you know, a little bit of imposter syndrome is always great because it helps you learn. It helps you grow. It keeps you grounded in the idea that I can always be doing this better. I can always learn something new. That there's always a, I'm never going to write a thing that's just like, boom, perfect. Don't touch it.
Yeah, perfect. Back right away. From
don't
the start.
Don't even look at it. Don't even look at it. You know, that's so. I think some of, you know, again, like I say, I've seen people who've been so consumed by the fact, even, you know, published authors as well, who are so consumed by the fact that they think what they've written is not good, that it paralyzes them creatively.
Right.
So I have had it, but when I'm feeling it, I go do something else because I know it's like this too will pass.
Give yourself a little break.
I've painted a miniature. I've done something that's released the pressure valve, or you know, I've stepped away from it. I've gone and, like, you know, when I was writing, when I was writing Vengeful Spirit, there's a scene. A long scene near the middle of the book, the Battle of Lupercalia. It's this huge set piece battle with Titans and tanks and Marines and so on. So it's a massive set piece. And in the beginning of when I started to write that, I was struck by not I don't know if it was imposter syndrome, but it was like I don't think I can do this. I don't think I can write scale of this battle. I don't know where to start. I don't know where's my through line. I don't know how to tell this battle. So I went off and I emailed Nick at the time, my editor Nick Kine, and said I'm really stuck at this bit. So and he was great. He was like, oh, well, you know, take some, you know, you're ahead of schedule on this one for a change. there's this other collection that we're maybe looking to get you to do a short story for. So, like, do you want to, you know, we'll jam some ideas for that?
Yeah.
So I went off and I wrote this other short story for another collection, and then when I came back to the novel, I was re-energized, because it was in the back of my mind. It was sort of my subconscious was percolating away with ideas and things I could do to tell this. And when I sat down to write it, then I was like, yeah, I know exactly where I'm going. I know how to do this. And, you know, I wrote the hell out of that scene. You know, and it turned out pretty good. You know, I obviously
needed
some reworks and so on, but I knew how to do it at that point because I had, you know, weirdly, because I hadn't been thinking about it, I knew how to do it when I came back. I did something else, and same with Mechanicum. You know, I got about a third of the way through the book, and I really, you know, the pace of the book was slowing and slowing and slowing and slowing.
Yeah.
And I was like, what's going on here? Why? Something's the cause here. And it's not just, you know, the muse hasn't struck today or whatever. It's, which, you know, is bullshit anyway. It's like, it was like something was fundamental. Something I hadn't done was missing from it. And eventually, again, there was a moment of like, oh my god, what's going on? Why have I slowed down here? I don't understand this. I know the story, I know where I've got to get to, I know what the characters are doing. Why is this not happening? Has the well run dry?
Have I done
all my best ideas? Is this me? I'm done now. Is it like, you know, is the gemstone in my palm lit up now? Am I bound for carousel now? Oh, is that it? But then when I found the note behind the note, when I realized, okay, what is the problem here? What's actually causing this? And when I figured that out, it's like, gotcha. And I back and did the thing. And because in that case, it was, I hadn't, you know, I'd fallen prey to my own kind of arrogance and thinking, I know this. I know how this works. I can have a bunch of books. I can do this. I don't need to spend all that time up front planning out, you know, the kind of story I'm going to do, the world building. Because we didn't, at that point, we didn't know a vast amount about Mars in terms of the 40K geography or the 30K geography of it. We knew it's the red planet, lots of forges, blah, blah, blah.
What's that's out there,
Yeah, I had, you know, I hadn't done the necessary groundwork, literally, to know where things were, how long it would take to get there, what was in here, what's the relationship of the placement of these forges and temples and Titanicus bases. So I was making things up, you know, I was building the airplane in flight, and, you know, for world building, that's never great. That's never ideal. No. So I went back to sort of first principles, because there's a couple of writing books I like to go back to every now and again, to go back to first principles to remind myself, oh yeah, I need to think about this, and just again keep me grounded. So, but when once I did that work, the story just boom, you know, came flew out. So imposter syndrome to me it feels like it's not like that. You actually don't feel you're good enough. It's like there's something you've forgotten, some fundamental part of the story you've either not done the groundwork for, you've not built out enough, or you don't understand something about your world and your characters or your story enough. And when you hit that roadblock, whatever it might be, you kind of, the creative personality naturally goes to that place of, well, it's me. I am not good enough. I can't do this.
And I can't come up with the ideas.
You absolutely can. Yeah. You just do your due diligence on the, you know, whatever it is, the thing is, and figuring out what's the blocker. And then going, I know what that is. I can do that.
Yeah.
And then that unlocks you. So it feels like it's more of a, you've forgotten to do some fundamental aspect of the craft of storytelling, whether it's, you know, world building, characters, or whatever. But then once you unlock that, you know, it's all gravy.
It's all about the preparation beforehand, before you even begin.
And again, that's my process. You know, I know a lot of people who've said, I like to go in not knowing a lot of the things, and I'd be surprised along the way. And, you know, if that works for a particular writer, more power to them. It's just
about that approach.
I get it, and I understand what it can bring to a story.
Sure.
But it's, you know, I like to have structure in place enough that I know that this thing will work. But it's got to have enough flex in it so that when the better ideas, as they inevitably are, crop up along the way, as they inevitably will, that there's flex enough to build that in. You know, I'm not suddenly going, oh, I've just thought this amazing idea that's just so perfect for this character, this moment, and now I've got to just dismantle everything.
Go back and change the entire story to accommodate the new idea.
I've done that before, and it's, you know, frustrating. But the thing is, once you see or understand a thing that's better, you can't unsee it. You can't unknow it. So if you try and put it to the side and just plow on regardless, it's always going to be there just gnawing at you. Yeah. It's like,
you want to do this thing.
Yeah. So just can't do it.
What actor would you cast as you in the movie of your life?
Vin Diesel.
Oh, solid.
Well, I mean, you know, he's a big, you know, stocky, bald guy, so, you know, I'll take that one. Jason Statham.
Oh, there you go.
Statham.
You know, I'm not sure. And
or either that or Mike Myers as Dr. Evil. I'm not sure.
These are all good. I'm still trying to figure out how Jason Statham's an action star, though. Not that I don't like him. It just seems really...
It's a mystery to me, because I remember seeing his first few roles, and then it's like, how did you become this, you know, sexy, bald action star?
Yeah, I mean, this tough guy now.
He gives hope to us all, but you know what? I think it's actually great. I mean, there's a Melissa McCarthy movie he was in. It was like a spy movie.
Oh, yeah, like I Spy, I think. Yeah.
She's like the data analyst who ends up in the field, and he's... Him and like Jude Law are like these playing like almost like spoofs of themselves, of the characters they kind of play. And yeah, he was. it revealed a new side to him. I was like, oh yeah, I like you actually.
Yeah, like he can be funny, right? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. You can poke fun at the persona that you have as an actor.
That's what you want.
Yeah, or, you know, in these later, you know, beard turning white days, I'll take Sean Connery as Marco Ramius from Hunt for Red October, or you know,
one of the best movies of all time.
It's the perfect movie.
I've made people watch that
movie.
I've made people watch that, and they're just like, "Well, I don't know what's going on." And I'm like, "Oh my god, are you watching the same movie I am?"
I love that movie. Michelle into history.
So good.
I'm a sucker for submarine movies, so that and Crimson Tide and Das Boot.
Yes. When he got to the New World, Cortez burned his ships.
So his men would never think of returning.
Oh, man. I've made so many people watch that, and they're not catching all the things that are happening. Like, maybe it's too much of a story. I don't know, man. This is another very important question, Graham. We're rounding it out here.
Big, deep ones.
These are deep. Tabletop war games are now an MMA-style sport. What is your theme song as you enter the ring?
Well, I've long, you know, me and the other authors, we've all talked about what entrance music we would have, you know, what we should have, you know, like when we come in for a book signing, you know, play.
You gotta have it.
Yeah, you know, like Jim always wanted, if I remember right, Scorpions, you know, Hurricane, Rock Me Like a Hurricane.
Yeah, that's a good jam.
Yeah, I've always thought of I like the Terminator theme tune.
Oh, the that one.
Yeah,
that's solid. Like you know what you're gonna get into when the Terminator theme song plays.
You know, it's gonna you know, lots of ultra violence.
Yeah, I mean, that's like my favorite kind of violence.
Something that either that or Du Hast by Rammstein.
Yeah, you need something heavy.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I couldn't have anything that wasn't. If it was a song, it would have to be something like that. The ringtone of my phone is a Slayer song called Americon, and I didn't want something that's built, because I thought it's a phone tune. I want it to start bang and go harder, so you know it's just da 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 da. So that would be a good one as well. Although I'd probably have to run down for that because it's too fast to walk.
Yeah, you got to be like super hype. But this is there to hype you up. That's what the music's for.
Exactly. So probably Americon, or if I'm going for this sort of more moody entrance, the Terminator theme tune.
That's good. Because I would do Van Halen's Just a Gigolo is what I would do.
Oh, good choice.
That'd be my jam.
Van Halen's good.
Have like a little, like, you know, finger guns pointing kind of dance as I'm coming in.
Well, yeah, you've got to do the Dave Lee Roth as you're walking down.
You got to do the Roth.
You know, do the flying splits as well.
Fly in on a wire, maybe fling a sword around. You know how he used to do that? And people are like, can you start the show? Why are we watching this?
Or I would take something like Dead or Alive by Bon Jovi.
Oh.
You know, on a steel horse I ride.
That's right.
So, you know, I'm a sucker for cowboy movie. You know,
Young Guns.
Young Guns too. I remember my mate from Glasgow, Parky. He and I went to that in full cowboy regalia.
Perfect.
I mean, because cowboy boots are my go-to footwear, to be honest. I was a cowboy. You know, the cowboy fashion was my vibe in my sort of teens to mid 30s.
Okay. I'm feeling it.
I would still, if I could get away with it these days, I would still carry it off. But you know, the boots are my one concession to that daily.
You don't wear the hat?
Not anymore.
there's a tinge of sadness in that response. There is,
yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, like at the beginning of Monty Python's The Meaning of Life, when they talk about, you know, the big boardroom at the beginning before the Crimson Assurance Pirates attack, you know, one of the things they're talking about, what's going on, he's like, people aren't wearing enough hats. And I can totally relate to that, because I love a good hat, like a good fedora, a good cowboy hat, but it just doesn't suit me particularly anymore. So I'm the same way.
I don't look good in hats.
No, I'm an Iron Maiden baseball cap, camo Iron Maiden baseball cap guy now.
That's solid. I have like one black hat, and it's the only one that looks good on me. And I'm like, I need a new hat one of these days. What am I going to do? This is the one.
This is the one. I mean, I've got my Sabaton cap as well.
Nice. It
looks pretty cool.
Are these old guy problems that we're having, Graham?
They are. We're descending into an age where our problems are like, we don't look good in hats.
No, so, you know,
if that's the extent of our problems, then we're doing okay.
It's fashion-based issues. Whenever you're old, it's like, I can't wear those.
I'm not 20 anymore. I can't wear that. These skinny jeans are not the right look for me.
I tell my boys, the guys are like, you always wear these tight pants. I'm like, they're not tight. They fit. They're fitted pants.
Just me that's getting bigger.
It's like, I'm the problem.
Yes, the trousers are fine. It's me that's
keep expanding and I can't help it. Anyway, says the guy who had a large muffin for breakfast. What is your most prized possession and why, Graham?
Ooh. I think certainly one of them is if we were on a video call, behind me you would see the axe snagger that I won for David Gemmell's the Legend Awards back in 2010.
Very cool.
That's sitting in a lovely sort of museum-like deep red velvet case and proper iron frame and so on. So that's up there. That's up there.
Very cool. And it's in a place of honor right behind your desk.
It is. Well, yeah, but when we all moved to Zoom chats and so on last year, my desk was, originally it was 90 degrees to the angle it is now.
Right.
And all I had behind me, you know, was just a featureless white wall.
So yeah, I
need to up my background game. So I,
you do.
And actually, weirdly, the turning it around, the feng shui or whatever, was unlocked because now like I can see my whiteboard. It's got all bits of notes on it. I can see the picture of Druss that my friend of mine who used to work at Riot, Eflin Mercier, is an artist, and he painted a picture, massive, like it's about a meter and a half by a meter painting of Druss the Legend. David Gemmell's books and stories and lessons have been a huge part of my life ever since I read Waylander back when I was like 13 or 14 or something. So having that axe behind me and winning the axe that has David Gemmell's name on it was a huge for me. Because it's been such a big thing for my life. So I've got all my my shelves of miniatures are behind me. The axe is behind me. So
yes,
you know, it's a more interesting back because especially when you speak to folk who are not as versed in the hobby as yourself, they'd be like, oh, what the hell? Oh my god, what's that you've got behind you?
It's cool. And I'm doing like a lot, so I'm still in, when I say still in school, I retired from the military and I was like, I need a different degree. So I went back to school and I do full-time school right now. And we do the Zoom classes and I spend a lot of my time looking at people's backgrounds to see where they are. And, sometimes I'm paying attention to the professor, but most of the time I'm kind of looking in people's backgrounds and like messaging them like, hey, what's that picture? What is this?
The story of their life.
Pretty much. That's like my thing, though. It's like I want to know about all these like little things. Like, why do you? This one girl, she had flowers in Red Bull cans on her wall.
Okay.
Like the Red Bull cans were mounted to the wall, and then a stem was placed into the can. And I said, "Is that Red Bull cans?" And she's like, "Oh yeah, it's just a private joke kind of thing." I said, "Oh, cool. Say no more. That's interesting."
Okay. I'm doing a rate my room thing for everybody when I'm on Zoom. Goes, oh, okay, that's cool. Oh, your room's boring. I don't like you anymore.
No good. Yeah, what do you got in the background? I have my books and minis behind me as well. I went over to IKEA and bought like one of those like big square like cubby hole things and
takes
up the wall.
My shelves are all open, so they collect dust like nothing on earth. I should really have got the glass sealed ones, but hey ho, we live and learn.
You know what? The glass seal looks pretty good, but it's just once you put something in there, it's in there forever. It's done.
Can't ever come out now.
No, it's like okay. Maybe I was like, I'm thinking I'll just change out stuff that I put in here. No, that stuff's been here the whole time.
That's never changing.
It won't. But I think I know this answer. But do you RPG? And if so, tell me about your character.
Yes. I haven't played as a character for years now. The last one we played was a game we played in Nottingham in between the Cthulhu ones that I ran. One of the guys at Workshop, Mark Rayner, ran a D&D campaign in the Forgotten Realms setting. It was the War of the Gods one, when all the gods fell from heaven and stopped answering their clerics' prayers and so on.
Oh, nice.
We played through that campaign. And I played a cleric called Decado, who was for my fellow players a nightmare.
Okay, nice.
he was the one who always you know, whenever there's a lever that says don't pull,
yeah,
he pulled it. I inadvertently got a couple of the characters killed when we were in this tomb, and I under people like, no, don't do it, don't do it. It's like, no, we've got, there's gonna be a treasure. And we opened up this sarcophagus tomb thing, and there was a mummy in it, and the character who opened the tomb with me, you know, the mummy dust and the mummy rot got into his lungs and ended up killing him. Another player, Alessio, he was swallowed by a mimic, and so I was like hacking the hell out of this mimic with a sword. But you know, yeah, some of the damage transfers to the character within it, and
he's in there. Yeah, yeah.
You know, I ran him through and killed him. So yeah, Decado was a nightmare, but he was a ton of fun to play. And although he was human to begin with, but then I prizing some gems from a statue, I was cursed by it wasn't Set, it was a snake god cursed me, and it turned me into another Durgar, the grey dwarves. So every time we went places, you know, civilization,
mm-hmm.
you know, people would try and lynch me, and half the party would always be trying, no, he's human, he's cursed, blah, blah,
he's a good guy, really, no,
actually, actually evil, and so on. And one of the fellow party members, John, he played a paladin called Narquelion,
mm-hmm.
and he and I were always at each other's throats, because I would be doing things that I wanted to do, and the paladin was like, for Christ's sake, we can't do that, you know.
Straight and narrow,
some of the philosophical arguments we had were a lot of fun.
And I think that's what I find most interesting about role-playing games in general, is like, you can literally do anything, especially if you're in the fantasy or sci-fi world where your actual abilities are beyond, you know, this actual world, and you present somebody with a problem, and like the last thing we'll just fight through it. It's like, okay, but there's so many other things. There's so much other things. Like, let's expand our minds and our imaginations and come up with like crazy stuff. Like, the crazier the idea, I'm like, oh, cool, yeah. You'll get extra dice. You'll get this. Like, yeah, cool, I'm down. Let's make this happen. And then you roll to see. Yeah, I love that. But just I'm just going to hit it with my sword. I'm like, huh.
Don't get me wrong. Sometimes that's exactly what you want. Sometimes you want a session where it's just like, you know what? Let's just go and kick the door down, kill the goblins, steal the gold.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Other times it's like, we had a situation once where it was a Cthulhu game I was running. And again, one of my favorite moments as a GM is when you almost don't have to do anything that entire session because of the ethical moment you've created. I mean, or you and the players together have created. There was a section. They came up to this. It was like a faith healer revival style tent where this guy was healing people, and they were there to essentially debunk this. But actually, it turned out he was healing people, and he was these people were actually coming away recovered from whatever terrible ailment was, you know, afflicting them. But then it turned out that there was obviously dark powers working through him, every time he did this work, it was bringing him one step closer to potentially being possessed, taken over, becoming a gateway for this vile ancient god type thing. And the characters got into this long debate about, well, we should just kill him, obviously, because it's too dangerous. We should just murder this guy. But look at all the people he's healing. You know, he's people whose lives are made better, and you know, and he's a human being. We can't just go up and murder him for something that might or might not even happen. So, I know, and the players, you know, in character, we're just going back and forth in this debate as to what to do. How can we tackle this? How can we save the day and not, you know, are you going to tell that the mother of that cancer-ridden child that she can't get healed now because you've murdered the guy who could have healed him, something? That was just wonderful to watch. You know, the players, you know, they owned that night. You know, I did nothing. They just went with it, and they were totally in the zone with their characters, wondering, look, what should we do? How can we approach this? And so on. And it was great. And I forget where I started on this one, but that was a great RPG moment. Anyway. But sometimes you want to hit things with swords. Sometimes
you need more.
Ethical dilemmas about the whether to murder somebody to save the world and the idea.
Yeah, and I think it's important, like, that you do have those, like, sometimes when I'm running one, I'm like, this is a legit escape from this place, time is running out, and then this one, it's like, well, you gotta sort of, like, think about who this person is, and how you know them, whatever, whatever, so you know, presenting them with those ethical dilemmas, though, that's like absolutely the best. And I love just like you just sitting back and seeing what they're going to come up with. And sometimes you're like, oh, my goodness, I didn't know people had this strong of opinions about this kind of
thing. Oh, yeah. I mean, my planning sessions the work I did to plan out each session were with the group I ran in back in Nottingham. It was very loose because, you know, I could never predict quite where they were going to go, and I never wanted to feel that they were being railroaded to a particular moment in the story. But it was always like, you know, like what challenges can I put in their play, and then I would have like three or four different outcomes for what, based on what I knew of the players and the characters. Okay, they'll probably pick something along this line, and if they do that, then we can go to here. If they do that, they can go to here, and you know. Almost, you know, I don't even know why I bothered doing that, because like 9 times out of 10 it'd be like, okay, I didn't see that coming at all.
They do a whole different thing every time.
Every session start, you know, it's like, I stab Gandalf. It's like, oh, come on.
You're like, cool. Well, thanks for playing, guys. Go ahead and turn in your player, your
yes,
sheets.
Yes. The Starry have just now killed you all. Sorry.
Oh, man. And I think, but I also think that's like, I like to be surprised sometimes too, where they we'll just do this. You're like, oh,
it's collaborative storytelling.
I didn't always think about that. Yeah, I love that. I'm way more narrative than I am crunch all the time. Like,
all the time. One of my favorite scenarios for Cthulhu is one called The Statue of the Sorcerer. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have any stats in it at all.
Oh, very cool.
It doesn't need it.
Yeah.
Nothing in the scenario is, you know, crunchy enough or requires it at all.
We're down to the last two, and these are very important questions, Graham. If you can have any weapon from any game, what weapon do you choose?
I think just for its sheer visceral nature, I'd want a chainsword.
Right?
Because it's an iconic weapon. I mean, it's a chainsaw. And it's a sword.
And it has the most potential for hurting yourself, I think.
Yeah. I mean, like the axe behind me, I the amount of times I nearly lost fingertips on that weapon, I don't know. I think if a weapon's not got the potential to harm you, then, you know, what's the point?
What fun is it? Well, I mean, I know I've used a chainsaw in real life and almost, like, cut my toes off. I don't need a chainsword.
That axe, it was sat before I had it in the box. It was sat, you know, because in the original stories of Druss, the axe was originally possessed.
There
was a demon in it, and he, you know, cast the demon out, and it's now a weapon. You know, simple as that.
Straight up.
And I was like, you know, I'm not sure. You know, I think it's still got a bit of the demon in it, because a couple of times it's like slid down or fallen off and like thunked into the wood of the desk, like a millimeter from my fingertips and stuff like this. And you're like, well, okay.
Just reminding you.
A chainsaw would be, that'd be cool to hang on the wall and, you know, ideal for home defense.
I think somebody made one.
That thing firing up. Could just be like, okay, I'm out. It's like the equivalent of like a, you know, popping of a shotgun. Some people hear that and they're like, I'm out of here.
Right, yeah. If you break into a house and you hear a chainsaw starting, you're going to...
Yeah, you're thinking, okay, this is... Have I just robbed Ash from Evil Dead? Okay.
I think... Did you see the guy that made the chainsaw? It was like...
I did, yes. Yeah. I did. I saw that. But,
How much for your chainsword, sir?
Yes.
And we are
chainsaw, because that's iconic for 40k, and it looks cool.
And you can just, I would spend all days just like cutting up watermelons in the backyard.
Absolutely.
So, Graham, we've made it to question number 20. This one's really easy. Do you have anything to promote that you'd like to put out there?
Let's see. Well, I mean, I think the Sabbat War book, it just went on pre-order just this weekend, and I've got a story in that. And the last couple of things I did for workshop were the Siege of Terra books, Fury of Magnus, and Sons of the Selenar. So if you could pick them up for me, that would be lovely. I'd appreciate that, and I think you would enjoy them.
Do it.
Beyond that, I'm kind of, a lot of the things I'm working on right now I can't really talk about just yet. A few of them are under wraps, a few of them will be announced soon, and a few of them may not see the light of day. They may in glorious form, I don't know yet. So I'll put a pin in a few of those things, and I'll come. When we speak again, as I'm sure we will, I'll hopefully have something more concrete to give you at that point.
Fantastic. Always a lot going on.
Indeed. Oh yeah, this my days are filled, that's for sure.
Well, I know that your days are filled, and I appreciate you taking time to speak to me and answer my strange questions. No, I had a great time talking
to you. Thoroughly enjoyable afternoon. Enjoyed awesome. It.
Well, thanks a lot, Graham, and I do hope we speak again.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure we'll speak again here, or when we get to go to Adepticon and places like that again.
Yes,
I'm sure I'll see you and speak to you there, definitely.
Thank you for listening to another Havocast podcast. You keep listening to them, I'll keep making them. All of your support is very much appreciated. If you ever need to get into contact with me personally, you can hit me on Twitter at TheLonelyHavocs, or you can find me on Instagram as well at TheLonelyHavoc. Drop me a line. Always glad to talk. Thanks for listening. Good night.